Hi.
Okay.
I'm here with Joel today. He writes Musings on Iraq, and we're going to talk about Iraq today. As a sort of programming note, we've been doing a series on Iraq, and the episodes are sort of out of order. We talk about something really specific one week, and then something really general, not general, but an overview the next week. When we produce enough material in the series, I'm going to put everything on Storify coupled with sort of interviews and sort of the links to the people we've talked to. So their works and their writing. So you can sort of read everything in a sort of order. Let me start off with Joel. Give us an overview of sort of what has been happening in Iraq for the last, 4 or 5 years? Because I think me personally, like my research stopped in 2010 when I basically finished my thesis. And I think, for a lot of people who are not keeping up with Iraq, that this sort of recent body of history of Iraq is sort of, it's sort of dense, and I don't think people are aware of it. So, I mean, walk us through, what's been happening? What are the big issues in Iraq for the last, 4 or 5 years?
Well, Iraq has gone through a lot of changes, some good, some bad, obviously. So I think some of the major events were the civil war ended in 2008. That was obviously probably the biggest event that's happened since the U.S. invasion. The government forces, the Shia militias, basically beat the Sunni insurgency. The Sunni split over who are they going to back. Most of them obviously decided to work with the United States. You had the forming of the Awakening Movement, the Sons of Iraq. The Sunnis basically realized they couldn't win in the civil war. They're getting pushed back in all different kinds of ways, so they switched sides. So that was a huge change. It went from thousands of people dying a month, obviously a huge insurgency. And after that ended, you just basically had a terrorist issue going on. So that was one big event. The 2009 provincial elections, I think, was a really important event. The majority of Sunnis boycotted the 2005 election. In 2009, they decided to be involved in the political process. You had this huge turnout. You had a lot of insurgent groups, even, that hadn't given up participating in the election. That was a huge change. You had a whole bunch of new Sunni politicians elected. Yet another really big drop in violence afterwards, too. You went down to maybe only 100, 200 people killed a month, So that was another really big change in security and politics. The 2010 parliamentary elections was another major event. You had Yadalawi, the Rakia party, won the most seats, and then Prime Minister Maliki outmaneuvered him and got a second term, which caused all kinds of problems. You had another national unity government formed afterwards, though. Everybody, including Alawi, got, parts of the government that doesn't work like all the previous governments because you have too many different groups involved. And then you had a whole bunch of events following that. They're still arguing over parts of the election to this day. You had the United States withdrawal. Obviously, the U.S. military pulled out its forces. At first, I didn't really think that was going to be a big issue, Iraqis, there's a big, Iraqi nationalist sentiment in the country, even with all the different sectarian problems and stuff like that. At first, I didn't really think that was going to be a big issue, but now I think it actually really has become a big issue because while the Americans were in the country, they made the security forces do counterinsurgency operations. That was one big thing. They helped mediate in places like the disputed territories between the Kurds and Baghdad. And since the American military left, the Iraqi security forces don't do counterinsurgency anymore. They're not, working with the populace. They don't do that kind of stuff. They basically do what the Americans did before when they first came in Iraq, which is search and destroy, mass arrests. They pick everybody up, including women and children, the families. They take them all away and stuff like that. That has had a really negative effect upon the security situation. Some other major events. Syria is obviously another really big thing that's happened. All the different political parties in Iraq have different views about the Syrian conflict. Some think it's a good thing. Some think it's a bad thing. It's affecting security because the Iraqi insurgents are connected to some of the Syrian rebels, like Al-Qaeda in Iraq.
has an alliance with the Nusra Front over in Syria. So you have a flow of fighters, money, material going back and forth across the border. So that's another big thing. And then you had the beginning of the Sunni protests, which started at the end of 2012, which is still going today. That's another major thing. That's a sign of alienation amongst a lot of Sunnis who feel like the government isn't treating them right. So I think that's basically a rundown of some of the major things that have happened over the last couple of years. I should also say that the oil industry had a big boom after security improved. 2009, they signed a whole bunch of oil contracts. That's basically running the whole economy. The Kurds are carrying out their own independent oil policy, which is another big conflict within the country. When security went down, you had a huge growth of foreign investment, not just in oil, actually. You know, there's a huge investment in housing, infrastructure, things like that. That's actually a positive, although there's big structural problems within the Iraqi economy. So you've had continuing political disputes. The security situation now is getting worse. The economy, some parts are doing good, some parts are doing bad. So it's a mixed bag of things that happened in the last couple of years.
Interesting. So, I mean, let me ask you, you know, how would you evaluate Iraq's political institutions? I mean, I think on your blog, you do mention that, you know, there's a lot of corruption. There's a lot of problems with the Iraqi Central Bank. You know, I think as a sort of general sort of question, how would you evaluate Iraq's, you know, not only its political institutions, but sort of its, you know, democracy? And I put democracy in quotes, but how would you evaluate it in the face of sort of, you know, corruption, the inability to sort of integrate the Kurds and sort of ongoing sectarian issues?
Yeah, Iraq is dysfunctional. That's the simplest way to put it. It's really dysfunctional. I mean, you know, you're coming out of dictatorships, you know, you had Saddam there forever. You have all these different political parties coming to power after the U.S. invasion, many of which, you know, had been in exile for a long time. You know, these are issues that are going to happen in a lot of developing countries. But, you know, Iraq is special because of the dictatorship, because of these invasion, because of the insurgency. It just makes everything worse. You know, you've got, like I said, every government in Iraq is a national unity government. So whether you agree with the government or the prime minister or not, all of them get a part in the government. They get ministries, they get government offices. And each one of these ministers basically runs, you know, their office like a personal fief. So they bring in all their family, they bring in all their political followers, they dish out patronage, you know, they steal tons of money. None of them cooperate with each other unless they're from the same political party. And even if they're from the same political party, they still get in arguments with stuff. You know, it's just, it's really, really, really difficult to get anything major done in Iraq is basically the problem. So whether that's building a new bridge, putting a new power plant, you know, working with oil companies, relations between the central government in Baghdad and the provinces, you know, between political parties, different political leaders. Personally, there's a huge amount of dislike amongst a lot of the leaders in the country that goes back years to the Saddam era. So dysfunction is the way to describe it.
No, I mean, do you think that sort of in terms of sort of Baghdad's relationship with you mentioned the Sunni protests. I mean, is this sort of inefficiency and corruption underlining, you know, all the other sort of political issues, like, you know, the Sunni sort of opposition against the central government, or, you know, development in the south, or even sort of the ability to bring the Kurds in more into the central government. I mean, is corruption sort of, you know, underlining all these other problems, or is it sort of, you know, the chicken and the egg, sort of the political problems create corruption, corruption creates political problems? I mean,
yeah, it's both. And corruption is actually like a grease that makes things kind of work in Iraq. You know, if you sign contracts with the government, you're expected to pay bribes. You know, if you want to go get some form filled out, you're expected to pay bribes. It's just from all different levels. It's, you know, the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, and even a lot of Iraqi officials say it's institutionalized. It's part of government. You go into government, you expect to get money. That's the way things work. That's the way, if you want to get anything done, you got to give money. So that's part of it. As for the Sunni protests, that's sort of like a different issue. Most of the provinces in Iraq get neglected by the central government because of a number of issues. Iraq really has a centralist history because of the dictatorship and other things. So the central government wants control over things. Each ministry wants control of their own personal thing as well, which leaves a lot of the provinces out in the cold, you know, like Anbar, Basra, or something. You know, we want to build this power plant here. We have to go through 10 different agencies and they can't agree with each other. Services are really bad as a result. You know, we want to blame somebody. For the Sunnis, it's like we don't get services. They feel like they don't get jobs. And then there's the whole sectarian issue on top of that, because they feel the reason why this is happening is because Maliki Shia, Baghdad is run by Shias. We're Sunnis. They're neglecting us because of that. So there's the lack of services, the bad governance. And on top of that, they add identity politics on top of it, which is the reason why they're having all these protests. You know, Baghdad doesn't care about us. Not only that, you know, they have all the security forces out here. They arrest a whole bunch of us. They think we're a whole bunch of insurgents. A lot of the Sunni protests think the Shia are actually Persians because they're Shias. They're not really Iraqis. There's a whole thing about calling them Safavids, which is from history when the Persians ran part of Iraq and stuff like that. So you have all these other things on top of it. They're leading to the Sunni protests right now.
So, you know, give us some, you know, what about, where would you put the Kurds in all this? Because I think in our conversations, you know, in our previous conversations on Iraq, we only sort of focused on the Arabs without sort of bringing in the Kurds. So, I mean, you know, in all this, you know, inefficiency, corruption, and sort of sectarianism, where do we put the Kurds? I mean, has their position improved, you know, since, you know, 2010, or, you know, is it high and mighty? What is the sort of political position and economic position of the Kurds?
I mean, if you lived in Kurdistan, I think things seem pretty great. They've got a huge amount of foreign investment going on there, especially from Turkey, but they get it from other countries as well. I mean, you know, people I've talked to, places like Erbil used to be really small towns, basically, and now they're huge, booming cities. There's just a huge amount of growth in Kurdistan. They're going on a construction boom. They have these huge suburban developments going on. You know, politically, the Kurds have all these foreign oil companies coming in. They're shipping oil to Turkey by truck, you know, which the central government doesn't like. So they're making some money on their own, although it's not enough to fund everything. You know, there's a lot of people think Kurdistan is going to become independent pretty soon. So on the surface, it looks really good for them. I think a lot of them are happy. I mean, in Kurdistan, there's corruption just like the rest of Iraq. Most time when you invest in Kurdistan, you have to have some kind of joint venture with somebody connected to a political party. There's tribalism in Kurdistan as well. The different political parties, Barzani's, KDP, and Talibani's, PUK, have huge patronage networks as well. Their family members have got all different kinds of government positions, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. So they have the same kind of problems as the rest of Iraq, although, you know, they have better security, their economy's more together, they have a more open, business-friendly environment. And so together that means they're getting more investment. But, you know, they still have a lot of problems as well over money, over oil, all kinds of stuff.
So, I mean, in terms of oil, you know, I think you mentioned that Kurdistan sort of sells oil, but I mean, is it oil that's underlining Kurdistan's boom? And I mean, does that sort of put it at odds with the Baghdad government? Because isn't there, if I understand it correctly, there's a sort of profit sharing, like that's part of the constitution. And that it's all required that, you know, a certain percentage goes to Kurdistan, but Kurdistan has to, the money has to go to Baghdad then. I mean, walk us through, I mean, what are some of the oil politics between Kurdistan and the government in Baghdad?
Yeah, Kurdistan is just as oil dependent as Iraq. Iraq is the second most oil dependent country in the world, and it suffers from what's called the oil curse. Basically, the oil industry is what the government focuses upon. It brings in almost all the money to the country, and it causes all kinds of structural problems because the rest of the economy isn't developed. And Kurdistan has the same kind of thing. Kurdistan, even I think the first oil contract they signed with a foreign oil company was actually in 2002, even before Saddam got overthrown. Kurdistan sees oil as a way for it to become independent, basically. So Kurdistan has its own oil law. It signed its own contracts with foreign oil companies. It's got all this development there going on. It wants to develop its natural gas industry as well. It has a deal with Turkey where it can truck oil to Turkey, and in Turkey it gets sold on the international market. Right now it's converting an old natural gas pipeline to an oil pipeline, and it's hoping this will allow it to independently ship oil to Turkey, although there's a whole bunch of problems with that. And this whole thing is causing all kinds of problems with Baghdad because the central government wants control of the oil policy. And there's parts of the Constitution, both sides can use parts of the Constitution to back up their point. Nobody really follows it, but there's parts of that. The main thing is in the what actually happens is the 17% of the national budget goes to Kurdistan, and that 70% of the national budget basically constitutes about 90% of the KRG budget, and 90% of the national budget comes from Iraqi oil. So the Kurds get oil from southern Iraq to fund the government, plus they've got their own oil deals going on. There's all kinds of conflicts over who can have control over this. Baghdad causes all their oil policies, all their oil deals illegal. And so it's just another thing that they argue about. And it goes off and on, off and on. So I think three times total, the KRG and Baghdad have come to an agreement where the Kurds can officially export oil through the northern pipeline that goes from Kirkuk to Turkey. And then it breaks down all the time because Baghdad doesn't like the Kurds' oil policies. So they say, yeah, you guys can export oil, but we're not going to pay any of the oil companies up there. We're only going to pay them a small fraction. And so then the Kurds say, you're not paying the oil companies. We're going to cut off exports. And Baghdad says, okay, well, you can do that. And so there's all kinds of arguments about oil policy. And it basically comes down to who's going to control it, the resources, the money that comes in from it. So it goes back and forth, back and forth.
Interesting. So let me sort of switch a little to the issue of violence. Now, I mean, how has sort of violence, you know, in sort of, you know, post-Civil War from 2008 till now, how has it affected Iraqi politics? Because it seems like, you know, there's an up and down to it. You know, the one month will be really high, and the next month will be nothing. And then, but it seems like now that the violence has consistently been high. So, I mean, walk us through, I mean, how has, you know, how does the violence affect Iraqi politics and sort of, you know, all the issues that we've talked about so far?
Yeah. Well, just for security-wise, from 2009 to 2012, there's a set pattern for how it was going to go. In January, Al-Qaeda and some other insurgent groups would launch a little offensive that coincided with some Shia religious pilgrimages and holidays and stuff like that. Then would die down. Then they'd launch a summer offensive. Then it would go down again till the wintertime, you know, around December, January. That was a pattern. Now it's just completely blowing up. You had before from 2009 to 2012, it was just basically terrorism. The insurgency was on the decline. I think a lot of them were probably turning into gangs and illegal activities because the fighting just wasn't working out. Now it's completely different. You've got a growing insurgency. It's taking off. It's not terrorism. It's way worse. It's just like the 2003, 2005 period. How that's affecting politics is a number of ways. The central government is really freaked out about the security, especially because there's elections coming up next year, another round of parliamentary elections. I think Maliki is really concerned and on the defensive because who are they going to blame for the deterioration of security? They're going to blame him. So he's going to lose votes. That's the thing.
So in turn, Malky, his blame, he's saying, he just gave a speech a little while ago, said Turkey's behind the violence. They always bring up Syria, you know. Syria's, the rebels are fighting over there, the country's in chaos. That's coming back into Iraq, you know. It's not our fault, it's not the government's fault, it's Syria. So they're trying to put a buff on that. She had politicians talk about Sunni politicians are involved in violence, you know, they try to blame them. There's just a whole different kinds of ways. So it's making the political situation more difficult a number of different ways.
Interesting. So, I mean, in the sense of what are the sort of the flows of violence? I mean, is this sort of Sunni groups and, you know, targeting Shiites, or is this sort of, you know, Shiites targeting Sunnis? And sort of is it more like internal, where it's sort of Iraqis killing Iraqis, or is this more sort of Al-Qaeda inspired violence, or even, you know, not just Al-Qaeda, but sort of, you know, sort of the style of violence we saw in 2006 to 2008, the sort of, you know, heavy sectarian, almost, you know, now I won't say like now it's a civil war, but where it was sectarian and where the themes were, you know, more about, you know, Sunni versus Shiite, or, you know, Shiite versus Sunni.
Yeah, there's two main groups that are responsible for the violence in Iraq. One is Al-Qaeda in Iraq. They're obviously connected to Al-Qaeda Central. They want to overthrow the government. They want to restart the sectarian war as a way to achieve that. So Al-Qaeda in Iraq, if you ever hear about any bombings in Iraq, that's probably Al-Qaeda. So since December 2012, they've actually been on the offensive. This is the longest offensive they had for years and years and years. So they're doing a couple things. They're attacking southern Iraq about once, twice a month. They'll set off some bombs in places like Basra or Najaf or something like that. That only happens while they're on the offensive, because when they're not, they basically leave it alone. It's a lot harder to set up that kind of stuff. So they're carrying out bombings in southern Iraq. They're carrying out bombings in central Iraq as well, Baghdad. You know, anytime there's any kind of Shia pilgrimage or anything like that, they always attack that. They attacked mosques, markets, things like that, in order to, you know, cause chaos. And they're hoping that the Shiites will respond and that will restart the civil war. The other group that's the most active are the Baathists, the Naqshbandi group. If you hear about attacks on checkpoints, attack on Iraqi security forces, attacks on Iraqi politicians, that's probably the Baathists. They're working in places like Mosul and Kirkuk and places like that, Saladin province in northern Iraq. So you've got them. You also have a whole bunch of other smaller groups that are still around carrying out attacks. And I think there's also, I think, some evidence that some tribal groups are also carrying out attacks on the Iraqi security forces. They're the people who are carrying out most of the violence. There have been some reports, and some people think that the Shia militias are reorganizing and rearming and carrying out retaliatory attacks. I'm not sure whether that's going on yet or not. I can't really tell from the reports. But there still are Shia militias, the League of the Righteous, the Hezbollah brigades. Most of the political parties, no matter who they are, they have an armed wing too. And they kill each other every now and then. You know, there's actually fighting, some internal rivalries and stuff like that going on. But I'm not sure whether the Shiites are retaliating or not yet. But most of the violence is coming from Al-Qaeda in Iraq and the Baathists. And they're going after the security forces and civilian targets.
Interesting. So, I mean, then where do we put sort of Muqtada al-Sadr? Because it seems like, you know, during the last sort of period of heavy sectarian violence, he was sort of key to that. Him and the Mahdi, Jaish al-Mahdi, was sort of key to sort of making that, the sectarian part of that conflict, even worse. So, I mean, you know, what is Sadr's position? Has his organization sort of made, you know, sort of discuss this violence or mention this violence in public speeches, or is it, you know, is the issue of reprisal and sort of going after these groups sort of not being discussed?
I think Sadr's main priority right now is politics. He is trying to make himself into a national politician. he did okay in the recent 2013 provincial elections. They're trying to organize, finish up organizing the new provincial governments. He's been able to get a lot of his followers, I should say, have been able to get a lot of positions in the new governments. And I think his main priority is politics. And he's really looking forward towards the 2014 elections because he would like to become the main Shia political leader in the country and surpass Maliki. So he condemns the violence. You know, he blames terrorists. He blames other countries for the violence and stuff like that. But I think Sadr's main priority really now is politics and trying to challenge Maliki for the leadership of the country. I think that's his main point right now.
So, I mean, what has been how has Sadr sort of transitioned? I mean, is this something – because it seems like, you know, I think, you know, in 2006, 2008, this was really an organization that was really violent. That, I mean, its politics was – it struck me as more hood politics. It was about controlling a neighborhood and sort of pushing out, you know, anybody else that, you know, wasn't part of that group. But, I mean, how has – Sadr handled the transition to being more of a national figure? Is his rhetoric, you know, more nationalist then? Is he, you know, saying, you know, making calls to being Iraqi as opposed to Shiite? Or, you know, how has Sadr handled this transition?
Yeah, it's a mix of both. As far as his militia, you know, the Mahdi Army, he actually never really had that much control over it. It was basically a bunch of neighborhood organizations who said they followed Sadr. And when he said something, they might listen to him, but basically they're doing their own thing. And that was actually a huge point of frustration for him because all different parts of his militia split off and they formed their own groups and he always got frustrated with them. As for right now, he really is trying to stress nationalist points. For example, a year or two ago, there was a big push to try to have a no confidence vote against Maliki. And Sadr played with that. He went to Kurdistan. He talked to Iyad Alawi. He was talking to Barzani. He was talking to all these different political groups and stuff like that, you know, to put him out there as a national politician. He talks about Shia issues still, you know, for example, he talked about Bahrain and the government's treatment of the Shia there. So he still pushes Shia issues, but also national issues as well. You know, he's got a huge network of offices throughout the country that provide services to people. His political party runs the most ministries in the Iraqi government, actually. A lot of them actually have to deal with services, like he runs the planning ministry, some other ministries like that. So, you know, they've been trying to push it. We can run the government, you know, we're not just a militia anymore. And so that's his main thing that he's been doing. He's been focusing upon social outreach services, his, you know, nationalist issues, as well as still pushing the Shia agenda.
So let me switch for the last part of our show to foreign influence in Iraq. Let me ask you in a general sense, is foreign influence still an issue in Iraq? I mean, do we still see, you know, Iran and Turkey and Al-Qaeda sort of being influential in the sense of, you know, something similar to the period from 2005 to 2009? Or, you know, especially with Iran, is it more sort of where these outside actors have to sort of negotiate and deal with Iraqi nationalism and Iraqi politics?
Yeah, there's still a lot of foreign influence. And if you listen to people like Maliki, they'll say that everybody's out to get them. They think all the Gulf states in Turkey are trying to overthrow the government. So there's still a lot of foreign influence. Iran plays a really large role. Iran has connections to all the various political parties, not just the Shia groups. Like, for example, Iran is really close to Taliban in the PUK. It's said that they have even ties to Sunni parties. I think Iran's main concern right now, though, is Syria. They really like Iraq, actually. I think Iran gets angry at Maliki sometimes because he always makes everybody else mad at him and he causes all these divisions through his policies. I don't think they like that. I think they'd like more calm and things to be, you know, regular in Iraq so they can deal with Syria. You know, so for example, Maliki just had this meeting with the president of Kurdistan, Barzani. Maliki went to Kurdistan. Barzani went to Baghdad. They're supposed to be making up for all their differences. And there's been reports that Iran really pushed that to happen because they want, you know, them to start stop arguing with each other. There's still a lot to trade with Iran. They're shipping material through Iraq to Syria, too. So that's one big thing. The Gulf states and Saudi Arabia back various Sunni political parties as well. Turkey has, you know, this huge trade, huge investment in Kurdistan. Turkey's trying to back Barzani. You know, Turkey also backed Iyad Alawi too. So you've got a whole bunch of different countries with, you know, ties and connections to different countries. So that's still all playing out in Iraq right now.
So I'm curious about the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq. I think they did a name brand change, but
yeah.
I'll go on their old name. Skiri and sort of the Badr organization. So, I mean, how would, you know, is there a tension there? Because it seems like, you know, Skiri is sort of integrating itself, if I understand it correctly, so correct me if I'm wrong, is integrating itself into politics in Iraq, while the Badr organization, you know, seems to be more loyal to Iran and sort of more willing to go to Syria. So, I mean, walk us through that. I mean, is, you know, are these organizations sort of Iran's hand in Iraq, or is there, you know, what are the sort of complexities and nuances?
Yeah, so the Supreme Council was created in Iran in the 1980s as an umbrella organization. Iran was trying to organize Iraqis opposed to Saddam, because that was during the Iran-Iraq War. And the Badr organization, which was originally the Badr Brigade, was their militia, and it was actually official arm of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. They have lots of close ties to Iran. They've actually split into two separate political organizations. The Badr leadership is sort of the old guard. This young guy, Omar Hakim, took over the party after his father died. The old guys didn't like what the new leader was doing. He's trying to remake their image. They split off. So they're now actually two political organizations. And the Supreme Council actually had this huge comeback. In 2005, they basically won most of the provincial elections in southern Iraq and in Baghdad. And so they kept control of most of the provincial governments. 2009, they got voted out of office because they weren't able to run the provinces that well. And now in this recent election, they actually did really well. They did way better than I thought they were going to do. They made a huge comeback. I think part of that is because Maliki's State of Law Party ran most of the south in Baghdad, and people said, you couldn't run the government. The incumbents, we're going to vote you out. So a lot of them ended up voting for the Supreme Council and the Sadrists. So they've actually made a huge political comeback right now. They're still close to Maliki, though, officially, but they've made a big comeback. The Badr organization ran with Maliki's party. They were actually part of the State of Law list during the 2013 elections. So they're two different political organizations right now. Badr is still really close to Iran as well. The head of the Badr organization, Amiri, who is the transportation minister, he gives speeches every couple months talking about, we've got to go send fighters and go fight in Syria. I don't know whether they're doing that yet. I think it's more talk. I think they're more, you know, just trying to give moral support to what's going on in Syria right now. But both of them, the Supreme Council and Badr, are still really close to Iran. They don't want to talk about it officially because it'll turn voters off in Iraq and stuff like that. But right now, they're both political organizations going in different directions. One, Badr, has decided to ally with Maliki. The Supreme Council works with Maliki, but they're like Sadr. They would like to become the dominant party in Iraq again, and they just did really good in the elections.
Interesting. So, I mean, this issue of Syria, then, I mean, how has Syria, you know, affected Iraqi politics? Because it seems like you've already mentioned that Iran is sort of using Iraq as a sort of transit of weapons and whatever to Syria. But then I'm interested in seeing how Iraqi politicians have reacted to the situation in Syria. Because it seems like, I think, didn't a couple of days ago, Maliki, he said something that, you know, the Sunni protests in Iraq are really just an extension of Syria, and that, you know, look what happens when there's chaos or something. I mean, you know, what has been the political effect of Syria on Iraqi politicians?
Yeah, he definitely gave that speech. Basically, each political party in Iraq has its own foreign policy. So depending on what party you talk to, they have a different stance towards Syria. So most of the Shia parties are completely freaked out about Syria. They think no matter what happens, whether Assad falls or stays in power, it's going to be bad for Iraq. They think if Assad falls, then a new Sunni government is going to come in power. And all these Islamists who are now fighting in Syria, they're going to be revived and they're going to come attack Iraq. And they say, look, Al-Qaeda in Iraq is already working with these Syrian rebels. It's just going to get worse. Conversely, if Assad stays in power, they think all those Islamists who lost, they're going to come back into Iraq and make the situation worse. So they're just freaked out no matter what. So Maliki's official position is that Iraq is neutral in the war. They've called for a negotiated settlement, but implicitly, they support the Assad government. They don't like Assad. Assad supported all the terrorists for all these years. Assad's a Ba'athist. But between Assad and the rebels, they take Assad. So Maliki is letting the Iranians ship weapons and supplies through Iraq to Syria. Iraq has given some economic aid to Syria as well. So that's the official position.
How is
You have some Shia militias.
I'm sorry.
Sorry, what were we going
to? Oh, no, go ahead. I'm sorry. I thought you had sorry.
Oh, you have Shia militias like the League of the Righteous and Hezbollah brigades. They're sending fighters to Iraq every week and every month. They're definitely involved in the fighting. They're working with the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and Lebanon's Hezbollah in the fighting in Damascus and the surrounding suburbs. So they're like right in the trenches fighting right now. The Supreme Council, the Sadrists, the Badr organization say they support the fight against the rebels. The Sadrists, some fighters have gone over there as well. I don't know whether that's officially backed by Sadr or not. But like I said earlier, he never really had control over his militia. There's all these different factions who have split off and stuff like that. So if you say like a Mahdi army guy went over to fight in Syria, you don't know who he follows. But definitely some people who used to be part of his organization have gone fight over there. You've got a totally different position amongst the Kurds. Barzani is seeing the situation in Syria as something that he can benefit from. He's hoping if the government falls, the Syrian Kurds can get maybe their own region of Syria and get more rights. He's backing one political party and one group of fighters in Syria. He's giving military aid. He's let their fighters go back and forth across the border. The problem is the group he backs isn't the dominant, the Kurdish group in Syria. So he's had problems with that. The Sunni parties, a lot of them support the rebels. They'd like Assad to fall. A lot of the Sunni protests say our struggle is the same struggle as Syria. They're getting inspiration. Look, these people are rising up against the Syrian government. We should do the same against Baghdad. So depending on who you look at or what group of political party, they have a totally different response and reaction to what's going on in Syria. Some think it's good, some think it's bad.
Interesting. So, I mean, how has this affected the relationship with Turkey then? I mean, it seems like Iran wants to prop up Assad, but Turkey supports the rebels and supports, you know, whatever their end goal is. But it seems like Iraq is sort of in the middle. So does it really go back to that each party has its own position, its own foreign policy, and that also includes its own views on Turkey and its own embrace of Turkey?
Yeah, it's the same thing. Barzani is really close to Turkey. A lot of the Sunni political parties are close to Turkey. Maliki doesn't like Turkey. Maliki's got a bunch of different disputes with Turkey over Turkey's relationship with Kurdistan, over Turkey's oil policy towards Kurdistan, towards, you know, I mentioned it earlier, Maliki gave one or two speeches where he actually said Turkey's behind the insurgency in Iraq and stuff like that. So you've got all kinds of different relationships with Turkey, again, depending on what political party you talk to. Some like Turkey, some are opposed to it.
So, you know, I think we've covered everything, but, you know, we like to always give the guest the sort of the last sort of comment or, you know, make sure we didn't miss anything. So give us before we end the interview, give us a sort of last comment or, you know, did we miss anything?
I think the one thing I'd like to point out about Iraq that a lot of people miss is that Iraq has tons of problems. Violence is going up right now. The government is dysfunctional. You've got all these ongoing political disputes, which aren't going to end anytime soon. At the same time, there's parts of Iraq where things are actually doing relatively good. If you live in Kurdistan, for example, there's no violence. The economy is booming. If you follow one of the political parties, you're fine, as long as you don't disagree with them. In southern Iraq, it's kind of the same thing. Every now and then there's a bombing, but it really doesn't affect everyday life. There's a lot of investment going on in southern Iraq as well. There's a lot of building going on in southern Iraq. I think a lot of people, because violence is going up, the attitudes are changing. I think people are getting more scared about the security situation. That is definitely a negative. But, you know, depending on where you go in Iraq, things are actually going pretty well. In other parts, it's doing bad. You know, Iraq is a complicated place. You really got to look at different things about it, different places, different political parties, different people are going through really different situations right now in Iraq. So while there's a lot of bad stuff, there's actually good stuff happening in Iraq right now. It's not in civil war. You know, just because things blow up all the time doesn't mean other things aren't going on in the country, because that's basically the image people have. Iraq's screwed up. There's terrorism. Things are blowing up. It's all bad. That's actually not quite true.
Interesting. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks a lot.